Hi, this is Pierre Gill. I'm on the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey, so who do we have on the show co-hosting today? It is Kays Alatrachi, composer of all of our music. How you doing, Kays?
Hey, I'm doing great, Ben. It's great to be here once again. I'm always hearing you guys talking about me like at the end of the show, and Now here I am back. So
always
thank
just
you for having me.
Talking smack. Yeah, well, I always like to tell people that, your main thing, your passion in life is being a composer, but you're also a great director. You're also a great visual effects artist. You're also a great colorist. And I'm not making any of that up. Like, I think the world of your work, and you're making all of us obsolete. And as you pointed out, both of us have the same poster in the background of our shot.
We do.
Alien Raiders.
Raiders. Yeah, which has been in the top 10 of sci-fi movies that many people missed. I was
gonna say the top 10 least seen sci-fi action horror spectaculars. A movie that we're both very proud to have worked on.
Of course. So, Ben, I'm so excited to be on this episode. Who is the guest today?
So the guest is an interview that Ilya did. So, by the way, Ilya is not here because he's in Australia being all fancy.
Whoa.
But it is an interview he did with Pierre Gill, who is he's the main DP. He's not the only DP on Dune Legacy, which is currently streaming on Max. And if you were to ask me about the interview, I have no answers because I'm going to listen to it with the rest of us.
It's a beautiful looking show. I mean, Christina and I watched it and it was fantastic. It just looks amazing.
Yeah, I didn't interview him, but my first question would be like, what's it like trying to step into the shoes of Greg Fraser, you know, one of the greatest living DPs? And I think that he's done having seen the show, I think he's done a great job of both inhabiting the world as created by, you know, Denis Villeneuve and Greg Fraser, but also has kind of put his own stamp on it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what I love about it is that you instantly feel like, okay, this is Dune, but at the same time, it feels like its own kind of thing. I really enjoyed the show. I hope the listeners check it out.
Yeah, definitely check it out.
And now, Close Focus.
So our Close Focus today, we should get into our Close Focus, is something that you suggested, and I'm going to throw you under the bus on this because, you know, like, it's a mildly radioactive topic. Take it away. What's our close focus today, Kays?
Our close focus today is, I thought we'd talk about none other than Emilia Perez, which is a movie that has got, I believe, like 13 nominations for...
Most nominations of any movie this year.
Yeah, which is really amazing. And even though the cast and the filmmakers that made the movie should be riding high right about now, there's actually some controversy around it. And it turns out that the lead actress apparently said some things on social media, but this was like a number of years ago. And of course,
it wasn't that many years ago. It wasn't like 1975 that she was writing stuff on Twitter. Right. It was like 4 years ago.
Yeah, but you know, just like everything else in today's world, you know, like whatever you do online has a tendency of resurfacing.
Yeah.
And it is resurfacing right now, a little bit at this not so great time. And what's happened is that Netflix is kind of sort of like distancing themselves a little bit. And I think, you know, like some of the other actors are also kind of trying to play it a little bit cool. And you know, I don't think we've ever seen anything quite like this before, and I thought
well,
it'd be interesting.
Not with an Oscar front runner. I mean, like this, Netflix has had many movies that have been in the mix for Best Picture or Best whatever. They don't tend to win. They'll win a few Oscars, but they don't tend to win Best Picture. They don't tend to win Best Director, or they don't Best Actor, Best Actress. They don't tend to take those home. and Carla Sofia Gascon, who is the lead actress in Emilia Perez, wrote some stuff. I don't, you know, honestly, you can look it up. I don't feel like right. like diving into the muck of it. I've read it. It's a little gross. It's also not the worst thing I've ever seen anyone put on Twitter. I shudder to think that someone might go through my my Twitter archives and find something terrible that I said in 2008. I don't think I did, but you know, who knows. Again, this wasn't 2008. This was like, I'm probably wearing pants that I bought when she initially tweeted this. It's pretty recent stuff, but also I have to say, like, I mean, like, you know, the Oscars are about hype and glamour and all that stuff. And it just sucks that, that one thing like this can bring down the whole Oscar campaign. Now, in addition to that, I will say that I have friends in the trans community who have not been especially happy about this movie leading up till now.
Right.
I also have
I
also have some friends in the Latino community who have said that they're not in love with the way that Mexico is shown in this movie. Now, I'm speaking from ignorance because I haven't seen it yet. And we're hoping to have the DP on soon, as he's nominated for Best Cinematography. And I've seen the trailers and I think it looks amazing. And it, on the one hand, like, I feel like, trans people have it bad enough in the world. They have a hard enough hill to climb without being portrayed terribly in media. And I don't know that this is portraying them terribly, but being portrayed. And also, I don't. But on the flip side, I'm like, is there outside of, you know, just having a movie where you know, we do nothing but rescue kittens? Like is that where it has to go, or can we have stories that are about complex people, which is what we want? And on top of that, is it appropriate for, you know, these tweets from, you know, 4 or 5 years ago to bring down the entire Oscar campaign? And it looks like it's working, because Netflix is basically distancing themselves, at least from Carla Sofia Gascon, who I believe is the first trans person ever nominated for Best Actress, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, you're correct. I think this gets into a little bit of that conversation about, like, you know, can you separate the art from the artist, right? You know, there have been like a lot of great artists in the past that have been somewhat controversial figures. As a composer, you know, like Richard Wagner comes to mind as somebody who was very strongly associated with the Nazi party. Do we stop listening to the music because of that, or can we separate?
I think that there's like a special dispensation when you're long dead.
Right.
Like, H.P. Lovecraft was a noted racist and anti-Semite, like noted, like outspoken. But I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting to read The Call of Cthulhu. You know, I think he died in the 1940s. Sure. I think we can separate ourselves a little bit from that. And I guess, like, when we're talking about the art from the artist, you know, this is not a position I would ever take. But I've had people say, well, you know, Bill Cosby was a great comedian. Sure. I have a hard time looking at an image of him anymore. Right. Roman Polanski, one of the greatest filmmakers we've ever had. I will cop to the fact that in the last 5 years I did rewatch Chinatown, but I have a hard time reconciling with Roman Polanski having done, you know, what I consider to be like as unforgivable an act as one could have done, and also doing it so casually as to make me assume that it wasn't the only time he did it. Would I equate that with tweeting things that are offensive? No. I think that, like, saying something on social media, like, some people are edgelords and they're just trying to get a laugh. Some people are garbage people and they're racists and whatever. You know, like, I don't honestly personally know enough about Carla Sofia Gascon to speak intelligently on what is in her heart, what she really means. But it will be interesting to see how it plays out, because I have to say, if you lose, not to get overly political, but if you lose the left on this fight, of course, the right doesn't want her to win anything either, you know, and it's sort of like, you know, you sort of become a person without a country. It's unfortunate again, because I feel like, you know, if the movie is great, and again, I can't speak from a point of knowing it, because I haven't watched it yet, but if the movie is great, it will be a shame that this would make people not want to watch the movie. And, you know, yeah, as someone who's made movies, and you've made movies, it would bum me out if the actor that you hired in the lead turned out, right, to be an asshole. And to me, this is where I kind of fall on this stuff, because, like, one of my favorite movies of all time is The Usual Suspects. You know, when we had Tom Siegel, exactly, on here, when we had DP Tom Siegel on here, Ilya was like, you can't talk about The Usual Suspects for more than 10 minutes. And I'm like, I could do 4 hours on The Usual Suspects. Now, that is starring Kevin Spacey, a man not unknown to controversy, and directed by Bryan Singer, a man not unknown to controversy, and a man, right, who, if the accusations are correct, somebody who I wouldn't want to support. But I look at that movie as a great movie. I don't personally believe that writing something on social media necessarily is that cancelable an offense. Like, you haven't committed a crime. You said something obnoxious, probably. I say something obnoxious 400 times a day. I don't often post at all. And hopefully I don't say anything that is offensive or racist, but what are you going to do?
Well, I mean, I think one of the interesting things that I'm curious about is if we are about to usher in an era where, before you get hired for a job, you know, like whether you're directing or starring in something, if you are going to be vetted, I mean, you know, if there's going to be like departments like at those major studios that are going to go through, right, your social history and just
here's the
say,
real
oh,
question.
Wait a minute.
Is could you like load somebody's entire social media feed into like Notebook LM and say, what if they ever said that could be considered offensive? And you know, like, I feel like an AI could probably do that a lot faster than a human being. And, yeah, you know, like,
but then it might make some stuff up.
That's true. It might hallucinate. don't get me started on that. But yes, correct. But anyway, yeah, but also it seems to me like if Carla Sofia Gascon was not going to be the lead in this movie, who would you have gotten? Like, she seems, right, about as perfect for the role as you could be.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, most importantly, I think that if, you know, I hope that regardless of, you know, her specific nomination, I do hope that, like, the other people that worked so hard to make the movie are not penalized because of something that she might have said. Because, I mean, obviously, they have no control over that.
Anyway. anyway, I think we should go ahead and get on with the interview with Pierre Gill.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
All right, I'm joined now by Pierre Gill, a cinematographer of the new Max series, Dune Prophecy. Hey, welcome to the Cinematography Podcast.
Thank you. Welcome. Welcome to me. I'm happy to be here. Very glad to be with you.
I'm really glad to have you on the show, too. You first came on my radar probably about 7-8 years ago when I saw a couple of short films that you had shot for like promo sort of teaser storytelling, mm-hmm, for the Blade Runner 2049 feature film. I was really blown away. And in some ways, I actually really enjoyed the work that you did and those short encapsulated, quick moving stories, perhaps more than actually the feature film. So I was like, you know, when I saw that, I was like, wow, I gotta watch it. I gotta pay attention to this guy. So I was really blown away by the work you did. You've since done a lot of other sort of science fiction work. I want to ask you, do you feel like you're starting to get pigeonholed in sci-fi? Is that your genre now? When they want sci-fi, is it call Pierre? Or tell me about how your relationship to sci-fi.
No, I love sci-fi. I love it. But, you know, is my how do you say that? I'm born under a star where actually I've been called all my life to do period project. I started like this. It's just total from nowhere. But I started to do, I did Joan of Arc, which is 1400. I did like Hitler, which is 1939. I did a Bible project and like Jesus Christ, nonstop. So sci-fi is the same, but like in another era. So I'm just very, very fortunate to be able to have, I did the Borgias, Casanova, I mean, so many things that is a period. And for me, it's a big gift because, of course, I'm working with amazing costumes and sets all the time. So it's always a bigger project a little bit. So it's more fun also, but it's more fun. It's not true, but it's great for lighting too, because you have a bit more tools usually. And I ended up doing sci-fi because I can work on pretty much everything, I think.
Yeah, I think sci-fi introduces, and you can speak to this, but you introduces unique challenges. It is exactly as you describe. You know, it's a period piece. It's a period that might be maybe fiction or way in the future or whatever it might be. But typically, to pull off science fiction well, I think there is more pressure on the DP, on the cinematographer, because we've all seen really bad sci-fi. We've seen sci-fi that even if the production design is okay, the lighting and the camera movement, if it is not in tune with that world, it really stands out and rings false. Can you talk just a little bit about your involvement in, like, in the back of your head, are you ever, I mean, you're getting to work now with these incredible budgets and with all these incredibly talented artists, but are you ever, like, conscious of, like, hey, you know, we need this to ring true, and if something that I'm not doing right, it's not going to sell into this science fiction world?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not about budget, because the thing is about, it's about lighting, and then when you do, it is like a period movie. So it's the same, because you need to, like, for example, I'll come back on that, but on Dune Prophecy, the challenge is there's not really a lot of light source in the concept of the universe. So we had to come up with something at least on the wall. But the Borgia or any period piece I've done of like 1800, it's you deal with fire and flame and candles. So it's a huge challenge all the time, because you deal with light sources that are hard to work with. On, I would say that more on Dune Prophecy, for example, because it was like respecting a bit of the Dune universe of Denis Villeneuve, and it was trying not to have too much like you know, glitter, little like sci-fi lighting. Because of course it's fun when you do a bit of sci-fi where you can have like in the Star Wars and you have lights everywhere in the spaceship everywhere all the time, and it's pretty cool. So yeah, that's part of one of the challenge for this type of show. I would say
it seems to me that everybody can pick out bad cinematography with science fiction. Like, that seems to me like the telltale thing.
Absolutely.
And it takes this extra bit of effort to really sell the science fiction world. And I think that sometimes you need to have the shadows, because maybe your set design isn't good or whatnot if you're working at the lower levels. But there is something more than just trying to hide things. There's something about the science fiction as an overall genre that I think might be the most challenging, I believe from my conversations with cinematographers, might be the most challenging world to create, because in some ways it's not something that we've seen, but it needs to feel like something that we've seen and we understand. And I feel Absolutely. Like for Dune in particular, your challenges might be doubled, because you've got to create something that is new and interesting, but yet also feels grounded in the you know, the recent Warner Brothers world of Dune. And I know you did some work on Dune Part One. Can you talk a little bit about then taking that sort of influence and bringing it forward into the new series?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's obviously it's a big task, and it was a huge challenge, and it was very stressful to say, okay, well, now I'm being called to do Dune Prophecy. It's a series, and what is the relation with Denis' movie, and what do we do? And the first discussion we had when I got the interview for the job, they asked me, so what's your take on it? right away.
Yeah.
without reading the script first. See?
So oh, wow.
Not easy.
Had you read the books or something? Did you have thoughts about it?
But you know, like I was in the world of Dune, of course, and I work on Dune 1 with Denis and all that, but I was, you know, replacing Greg Fraser because he was shooting the Batman at that point. But my first thing was to say, well, I don't know, but personally, I love the movie so much. At that point, there was only Dune 1,
yeah,
and Dune 2. And Dune 2 is like even more incredible. But I said, I love the movie very much. It's very powerful. I love Denis Villeneuve's work. And I think that as an audience, if you ask me as a tourist, I want to turn on the TV on HBO and watch something that relates to that. I don't want to go somewhere else. I need to stay in that zone. It's a great zone to stay in. So I think it should follow the path of what Denis has created in the new Dune, because these films has been shot 3 times already, at least from many directors, Zarkowski and whatever. But so, you know, and then everybody was like, okay, that's probably the way to go. And I was like, I think it is. But of course, we could have done anything. Mm-hmm. But to do anything is complex, because you need to keep the audience to follow the path of what's going on. I think it's very important for the series and also for Denis' movie. To stay linked like this a little bit, it's going to make a lot of people, like, and I even witnessed this already, some people don't really understand the movie, or it's not their thing. But because the series is a bit more, it's a series has more scenes, more plot, more subplot, blah, blah, blah. Like my girlfriend, for example, she loved any movie, but when she finished the series, I called her at one point, she was like watching Dune at night alone. Like she was like, I need to see the movie again. And I understand so many things now. So, you know, so it's pretty good. So that was actually the idea, I think, for me to say, okay, let's stay there. But at the same time, it's difficult because as a cinematographer, I'm like, I don't want to recreate what Greg Fraser, the master, did. I don't want to copy him. I don't want, what do I do? So it was a big challenge. It was a lot of, it was a very specific moment of my career as a DP, because it's not every day that you get with that kind of like situation, because it's easier for me to create from scratch my own ideas or this and that. Is it better or not? I don't know. But so I try to do one thing. What I try to do is to say, well, I know, first of all, I know Denis very well. I've shot Polytechnique with him. So I shot a complete movie with him at a very important movie, very difficult movie about the shooting of this in the school. And it was very dramatic. And it was a very, very strong moment that I had with him as a filmmaker and a partner and all that. So I understand his brain a little bit. And then I did a little bit of reshoot on Arrival. And then he invited me to do second unit on Blade Runner with Roger Deakins, for Roger Deakins. And then he called me to finish his movie Dune 1, because Greg was doing the Batman, and I was very, very honored to be called for that. It's a very difficult challenge, to be honest with you, because I had to copy Greg Fraser to the dot. And I mean, you know, every DP has his own style, and this guy is like really on top of the game. So, but I'm very happy. I think I succeeded on that. And
you did just fine.
Even Greg was like, oh my god, Pierre, thank you so much. It's like everything is, I don't know what I shot anymore. See, it was like perfect. But the thing is, this is like, just to come back to this, is that Denis, I knew that there was one thing I wanted to keep from him going into the Dune series, and to bring to the production and the directors, is to say, look, he's very like, it's strong. So let's try to stay strong. We do wide shots, we do little people, we do big close-up, we center the camera as much as we can. There's this beautiful cinematography that Denis is doing in all his movie. I just watched Arrival the other night again, and I was like, wow, see, a lot of symmetry, a lot of like eyeline. I force everybody to look close to the matte box. I got the actors often not to even see the other actors. I'm used to do this. I like to be involved and try to you know, talk to the actors also at the beginning when I meet them to say, we're anamorphic, so sometimes you have to look in the matte box. Are you okay with that? And a lot of like very experienced actor would say, yeah, yeah, Pierre, no problem. Give me a tape. You know what? It's very strange. Often they really like it. And I'm very surprised. It's like they like to play without seeing the other person for some reason. And I think I would understand why. It's because at one point to do a scene 20 times, maybe at one point it's better to do it alone because you cannot get the same reaction from the other actor. Of course, I don't know. That's what I think. I'm not an actor, but we did that a lot and I tried to keep the eyeline and stuff like that. So, you know, that was a bit the idea to keep at least the core of the Dune feel that Denis created.
I love that story. And I'm just going to quickly editorialize for our listeners who don't understand when you're talking about the actors having to talk into the matte box. But, you know, quite often if you, you know, depending on the position of the camera and the position of the eyeline of the actor may not be able to see who they're acting with, or there may not even be someone there. And so a little piece of tape gets like stuck on the end of the matte box to give the actor the eyeline for them to be able to say, ah, that's where I should be looking. So this will cut. And you're right. I would imagine that for some actors that might be very disconcerting because, like, you know, then suddenly they're just looking at a piece of white tape against a black piece of plastic that is no longer where the actor is they were working with. So, all right.
But
so,
we had young actors and they all also they got into it and. And you know, it's the reality. It's good that you explain what it is looking in the matte box. And because the eyeline is so critical, it's the number one thing. Because in movie making, you want to see the eyes. It's about the eyes, nothing else. You can be, whatever you do, three-quarter shot from like, you barely see, you feel the iris, boom, you're good. You love the, you feel something right away. So there's a lot of like little details about cinematography that people... might not know that you think you're just like doing creation. No, you're doing calculation, a lot of it.
Yeah, I watched a little of the BTS for Dune Prophecy. And in one sequence in particular, I noticed dueling Steadicams, two Steadicams operating during a fight sequence. Do you do a lot of two camera work on the show? I get the feeling there's a lot to cover and a lot to get through. Is two cameras sort of the standard modus operandi, how you get the days done?
Well, in television, two camera is almost a must. Okay, that's the starting point. If you do a TV series with one director that's doing the whole series, it's like doing a long movie. So maybe you can use more of a one camera thing because it's very, very focused. But we change directors, not that much on this show, of course. But it goes with like, okay, it's not... We have a tendency to use two camera as much as we can. I'm very used to it. It's okay. I'm a very, very... I've been doing, I think, at least 5 shows with 2 Steadicam. I love to have 2 Steadicam going together and do a ballet. I love it. I think it's great. I get the 2 operators. We do a choreography and they each take... It's like a football game and they... Okay, you go left, you go right, you go this way, you take that. You go on the close-up when he goes on the wide, you go low, you stay high, blah, blah, blah. So on this one, I brought the second Steadicam. Of course, the producer at the beginning are always like, no.
Of course. Steadicam's a little expensive for some people. And
it's just more expensive. And I'm like, yeah, but you don't understand. It's going to save the day. And so on this show, I brought the second Steadicam maybe like after... You know, a month in during the shooting, I said, hey, let's bring in the other Steadicam. Trust me, it's going to be good because a lot of stuff we're doing, it's not easy. It's long setup. The sets are, you know, not easy to work with and all that. So there was some good reason. And my main A-cam, Steadicam operator, Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire, my petit chat, he's great. And he's really like the main Steadicam up and A cam up. And then I brought a guy from Budapest that didn't have as much experience, Chaba, and we teach him as much as we could, and he learned a lot, and he t- took a big curve. So it was very cool to see. He grew up a lot. He became much better. And then Geoffroy was like actually embracing him. Okay, come here. You're going to go there. I'm going to go here. And you're going to do this. And I'm going to do that. So it was really cool. It was really, really cool. And we did a few sequences. Fight sequence, of course. But we did more than that. We did all the wedding. After the wedding, there's little in episode one. And little Plouette has this AI machine, thinking machine. And it doesn't show that much because in editing, once it's edited, you don't know that. But they could edit the way they want everything. We have so much coverage of that scene. And it was longer and it got shortened, of course, because they have to, you know, get the rhythm to go and everything once you start the editing. But so we did a lot of ballet and then we started to use it a lot. So, yeah.
I think it's really interesting how the show focuses on parts of the Dune story that we haven't really gotten to see before. I know it takes place 10,000 years in the past, but now we're getting into sort of the Bene Gesserit, sort of like lore and all of sort of like the formation of that. There is these opportunities for you to kind of go to places, to unexplored territory that people haven't seen before, that don't have necessarily the preconceptions. You got to pay tribute to the world that you're in, but do you enjoy getting to sort of create these new spaces that are essentially or more or less a blank canvas for you, that don't have the, you know, it's not something that's been established by the movies. It's not something that's been established previously in a shot here or there. It's something new that you get to create from whole cloth. What's that experience like?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big thing because the reality is that it's a huge production, okay? So, of course, the production design is massive. So then what happens, the reality is that there's artwork, there's like drawings, there's ideas of what this looks like, what is it, ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. But you're not shooting in a kitchen, so you cannot prep it like prior to it. It's really a process that is extremely complex because you get very close to the end and then you get your big set with finally the elements inside. So the challenge at one point is you have to make it work. I mean, it's technically so challenging, it's so big, and it's a lot of it is in camera, okay? So of course the VFX are phenomenal in the show. I like, they're really great actually. But the most of the set, the people are in this real set, meaning behind them, the height is real. There's not a lot of set extension, I would say, about that. So, because this goes with a lot of discussion about, okay, what should be the show? What is 10,000 years before? What is this? What is this? And you finish by just, you know, like on the edge to make it work as best as possible and keep it there and make sure it's gonna work. You end up I didn't get the opportunity to really, really explore what different possibilities. On this one, I got the set on Friday and we shot on Monday, the sister would say. So it was pretty, pretty, pretty crazy.
Yeah.
So I'm very happy and proud of the result. I wish I could have really play more with it, but this is what I really hope to have season two. I hope to go back there because it's going to be much, much, much more creative in that sense, to bring worlds in a different place. So what I really try to do is to keep it in a very precise place. It's like, okay, the Wallach Nine and the Sisterhood is going to be cold, soft, and grayer. And let's go as much as we can. Keep it there. And the other world will have these hard shafts of white light and sun and more warm and this and that. So at least one thing is important is like as you watch it, because it's a TV show, it's not a movie, very different, because you're going to have more scenes and more edit points. So for me, it's like, okay, keep the audience, don't lose anybody. You know, and the stories are already complex, and make sure you know where you are. That's very, very priority. and that you follow all these points all the time.
A lot of the set pieces in Dune Prophecy have ceilings. They have clearly visible ceilings, which do not appear to be set extensions, which appear to be part of the production design.
Yes.
When you have a ceiling, that takes away one of the, you know, quite often one of the cinematographer's tools is the grid, the ability to put lights wherever they want above. How does that change your ability to light or put lights where you want it? Or do you love working with ceilings? I know you get a lot of lower angles too, so we can really see some of these gorgeous like wood ceilings and things that are there. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the changing of the changing of your environment for, to be able to create the light? Because now I got to imagine that unless that ceiling comes away, it's a lot harder to put some lights where you want it up above.
It's much, much harder. I mean, first of all, I love ceilings, but it's such a compromise of lighting. It's crazy. But I still kind of love, I think it's, I'm a bit masochist on that. It's like, I'm like, okay, it's going to be painful, but it's going to be great because I love the camera to be a bit lower. I love to feel that depth. I love the anamorphic also. In anamorphic, you have more of the set behind you, so you see a bit more. So what I try to do with the, as much as I could with the production design is to create some openings in a few places. And I think that some sets, there's absolutely no ceiling. So I try to incorporate little LED lines that there was not a lot of lights when I got on the project. Mm-hmm. And I was telling Tom Mayer, which is a phenomenal projection designer, which did amazing stuff, but he was very Dune style. And I said, well, I know Greg Fraser has 3 hours to do to prepare a lighting setup, and then he goes away. I know that. Trust me. It's not going to be my world. I don't have this time. It's really different. The DP has a big, big task on their shoulder, not be creative. What is the time? Hey, Pierre, how much time? How much time? How much time? From the 80s all the time. See, you're like pressured. And I'm like, I need help. I need some little... So we created actually these conchs that you see in the, at night, and there's big teardrop, we call them. They're like long teardrop. I got them, the art department, to create those, and it was like our plan, okay, how many LEDs, it's on the board, da-da-da-da-da-da. To cope a bit with the ceiling situation. And then some places, because there was an opening in the ceiling in the center, and so it does help. I worked I tried to also, it was a bit of a team from Greg Fraser, I have to say, because he uses a lot of like the soft light and the top soft light and all that, and I wanted to embrace this a little bit, so I was like, okay, we'll start with that. But to be honest with you, my challenge was, and I know Denis said, because I work on the movie, and it's, I know Patrice Vermette, the production designer, and it was like, I was like, my sets were very high, like really, really high. Yeah. Seriously, 45 feet high, like a lot.
Wow.
And this is huge. So my problem was, how do I light faces? Because that's too high to light. So I created with my rigging grips, and lighting team, we create like these very small, multiple, movable soft box that were all like on the board, and I could move them around all the time, going down. So I even created like outside in this, we call it the lip, it's outside of the palace at night. And I don't know if you saw it, the episode 6, there's a dinner, a big dinner with actually Taboo. She's there, everybody looks good. I created a giant soft box, like super soft, crazy bounce with muslin. Oh, wow. And I brought it down so low, it was just about like, so it could go at 50, 60 feet high, and it came down when I was doing all the table, and I took 3 cameras, and I said, we're gonna put 3 cameras, it's gonna all look great. And I brought this down. It was like this beautiful box of bubble of muslin that I brought very low. That was pretty cool.
It sounds like lights are then on the ground and you're shooting up into the box and then it's reflecting down. Sort of like a floating book light up above the table.
Exactly.
Which is...
It's a all-in-one book light that is you can carry around and use... And I had those also for the spaceport, which is this big space place that they come at the end. So, yeah.
Just out of curiosity, and I usually don't get this technical into the weeds, but I haven't heard about someone doing what you're describing right now, especially with multiple brakes. But what is your reflective surface that you're going into? Is it is it aluminum reflectors or shiny boards, a Griflon? Do you what is your flavor of choice for creating your booklight?
No, I would reflect into a white material. Mm-hmm. Which half silk or grid cloth. And to be honest with you, at this point, because I'm also we have money, but no, we don't have enough. So I'm very, sometimes I tell them, what do you have? What can you put inside? Because the bounce part of it doesn't bother me that much. If you can get a cheaper material, it's fine. What I care about is the other piece that the light bounce back into. So this has to be like silk, or it's going to be light grid. So this is where, you know, I'm going a bit also with what we have, because to be honest with you, if I say this, it's not because I don't have a specific decision to that. It's because we have actually at the same time, we have like five different gigantic sets and we have these boxes everywhere. So I mean, the quantity of material is like pretty, pretty crazy.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating. That really sounds like a cool rig. I know exactly the scene that you're talking about. I want to talk a little bit about episodes 5 and 6. I think that episode 5, in particular, there's this last shot. Okay, so the Empress and Desmond are plotting and sitting together, and there's this wonderful sort of like black light, and it ends in this like two shot in profile, and we've just sort of like pushed into him a little bit. It's a wonderful moment, and something about everything that seems to involve, like the Imperium, is like, you know, there's all this plotting, and I almost want to say it's like, it's Game of Thrones-ish. It's not Game of Thrones-ish, but there's a lot of drama. There's a lot of.
Well, that's fine. Yeah, that's, yeah. Everything is the same, man. Just so you know, Star Wars is the same. Game of Thrones is the same. I mean, the stories of movies are already a bit the same. Plotting, but, and it is. So it's nothing wrong to say that.
No, of course. But you know, it's also HBO, or now it's Max. But it's like, you know, Succession. There's all these, this sort of like building of like this intrigue and drama, and this feels like it fits right in the same sort of pantheon of all these types of shows that have come before. And it's just such a simple and static, and simple and static is never easy, because that gives the audience time to really sit and look and analyze on it. But like, one of the things I really appreciate the show is these moments where we get to like completely just lock off, and what happens in front of the camera commands all of your attention. There is not a bunch of extra visual effects. There's not a bunch of camera movement. There's not a bunch of things that distracts you from what is happening between the actors, between the characters in front of the camera. Can you tell me how, like, I'm sure this is intentional, but like on moments like that, it would have been so easy to have done something else, or done something else that it was completely not needed. It's like a form of restraint. Can you talk a little bit about like these moments? I'm sure you know the moments that I'm talking about, but that's like a really big
absolutely.
Moment.
Absolutely. I'm so happy you talk about this one, because it is actually the essence of what, you know, I was preaching for at the beginning, when I say, okay, we have to keep it in the universe, as Denis, is the strength, the symmetrical, the smoothness, the slowness of it, which doesn't feel slow at the end. See, I remember when I watched Arrival, I told Denis, my God, it's so slow, but it's so fast. I don't know how you do that. It's crazy. It's like, but anyway, To come back to this, it's such a good moment, and I'm so happy, first of all, in editing, they kept that. Because this is where you prove that this is what works. Because we had to shoot the front on angle on both, so we do have those really tight shot of them next to each other, looking at each other, which were actually pretty good too, but the profile, I mean, me too. I'm like, you talk about this, I'm like, yeah, it was awesome. Now, one of the reasons is this, and the magic of movie is when the shot is longer than the audience think it's gonna cut. This is always the magic of movie making. That's why it's more powerful in general than television, because television, they cut and cut and cut and cut and cut. Now, in movies, the most beautiful things you go on and then you hear the other person talk without cutting and you keep going on the face of the actor. So at least on a show like this, there is some of that. And this is really good. Well, that's one moment that you talk about that I love very, very much. And of course, me and another director were like drooling, like, oh my God, look at this shot, it's so great. Because you plan it, but you don't know how it's gonna end up, you know? What it ends up is when she comes in and she's so good and she's so powerful. And him, of course, Travis has this crazy, beautiful, photogenic face. So he's like just biting the light there in the camera. So we had this camera set for that. I think maybe at the same time somebody was shooting like, you know, front on out of frame, but they kept that. I'm so happy. And it makes the end quite powerful, actually. It helps a lot. So these are very, very important moments. And we try to do as much as possible. Sometimes, of course, there's a bit of a, like I say, it's when you shoot television, you give a little bit more coverage, and a lot of it is the reason is a lot of it's because of the timing. It's not because they don't want you to do a long shot or something like this. It's more because, especially high end television like this, you know, they let you have, you know, very quality things and not just cut in a close up. What I call a potato to a potato to a potato to a potato.
Sure.
So, but that was, thank you for talking about this moment, because this is exactly what, you know, and I think, to be honest with you, that now the series is done, everybody's relaxing, the network, the producers, everybody is more, it's quite happy. If we go and see, well, it goes on season two, apparently, of for sure. Well, let's hope, but it's going to be even
it's been
more
announced.
Powerful, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, sure. It's announced and it should work, but it's going to be even more powerful, I think, because now everybody feels confident and stuff like this will happen even more. You know what I mean? Because it's... and what it's great about this, it's because you leave the actor play their own thing. And the great thing is to have two people in a shot. Because when you have two people in a shot, that's why I love to do also shot body shot, where you see the arms, the knees, and you see people movement. It's just that the head floating in space, you know? And also, of course, that shot specifically has this great, I was able to light both pretty nicely in terms of like, not too much silhouette, but with a little hard edge and have a light on their eyes. And it makes this longer shot more powerful for sure.
All right. Well, I want to talk a little bit about episode 6, sort of like leading into season 2. And we don't usually go too far down the technical rabbit hole, but do I understand correctly that season 2's already been shot? Has that happened? Or no? It's just been announced that it's happening. So
Yeah. No, it's just been announced.
Okay. So do you know when the band would get back together again, so to speak, if that's happening? And how conscious are you and the creative team that quite often when there is a season two, the finale sort of episode of the season ends up getting rewatched more often by people trying to remember all the things? It's like they don't go back and rewatch the whole season, but a lot of people go back and watch that finale episode a second time to try to, like, you know, make sure that they reimmerse themselves in the world. And oh yeah, I remember that, because those finale episodes tend to tie up a lot of loose ends. They tend to ask a few more questions. How conscious, especially in a show like this, is the team of thinking that, like, oh, this is an episode that's going to get seen a lot because when the season two comes out, everyone's coming back to this again? Or is that completely furthest from your brain? You're just trying to get it done.
But seriously, look, first of all, I cannot really answer it, to be honest with you. The thing I can tell you is that, honestly, that when I got called for that, and I got 6 scripts, and that was it. And there was, the only thing that happened is that I read those scripts one by one before, way before getting there. And I remember at the end of six, I was like, oh my God, I want a season two. Mm. When I read it, I was like, oh my God, there's going to be season two. So I don't know. The only thing I know is that it was an ensemble. It's an ensemble, these mm-hmm. six scripts. They really go together. But that's all I know. At the end, that's all I got. That's all I know. And we never discuss what's next. Mm. And we took the project as a, it was a big enough project to, okay, let's go. This is what we have to create. How do we get there? And as we shoot, it was the showrunner, Alison, slowly changing a few scenes, putting seeds, you know, because they're like, okay, well, they're also figuring out, okay, because the six episodes together are working really nicely. Mm. And this was the first six episodes was pretty cool because it was like actually explaining a bit, oh, okay, the Harkonnens and the Atreides, they met each other back then. Oh, and she killed them. Oh, so you know what? Then you go, oh, like when you say about the Game of Thrones and all these little plots, like, okay, who's bad and who's good? And it was a big thing. And that's all I know. I mean, at the end, we finished the sixth episode. And episode six was, I think we shot also two different endings. And mm-hmm. the one they use is they get on Arrakis.
Yeah,
which I love because it means if we go back, we're gonna shoot some Arrakis stuff.
Can you talk just in the last sort of little bit we have here? Can you talk a little bit about your technical package, cameras, lenses, workflow? Is it Arri cameras? I'm taking a guess here. I couldn't tell from the BTS. What did you guys use for the show?
Okay. Good. I used the Arri, the new Alexa 35, mm-hmm. and it was the first time I use it. I shot a lot of Sony Venice recently. I shot Percy Jackson with it. I shot also Dead Boy Detective and My Siri Transplant, and I shot a few things. And I love the Alexa, of course, but the Venice was a good tool with more possibilities. Then the Alexa 35 came up, and it's pretty much like a Venice in the Arri world, I would say. So it's very clean. So it's a big task for a cinematographer because it's so clean and it's not easy. But it has a beautiful sensor with a lot of color rendition, nice color rendition, and it's better in a certain way because you can actually finally shoot with a higher ISO without worrying. And the Alexa is great, but it's when you push it too much, it goes grainy right away, and it's not something you really necessarily want all the time. So what I've done is was very important. I do this all the time. I do many tests with different lenses, and I test every Panavision and Arri lens and everything. And they're too sharp. I think a lot of them are very crisp. And I used the Cook, the old Cook for my Percy Jackson. It made a beautiful mix with the Sony Venice. And this time I was able to find the Vantage Aux Vantage Class X. So they're 2x anamorphic lens.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're very, very beautiful, very soft. So it's good for skin, which I like. And I knew I had a lot of women also, and mm-hmm. I have to, you know, take care of this too. You know, you want to go on a softer side. There's no point to be hard on that.
Sure.
And the lens were great, and they're anamorphic, and they're very small and light and close focus. So there was many little things I love about them. So basically, I had this. I do my own color correction on set all the time. So I use a live grade. I have my tangent KB. I have my buttons, and I create a lot. The lot I created to have a super, super, super soft black because I'm going to have gigantic set. And then the costumes were pretty dark. So I need this long curve, and I want this show to be very cinematic and soft. Mm. But I change a bit of color values in my lot. But what I do all the time, because a lot is kind of problematic to work with a lot because it creates a look on every shot.
Sure.
And The problem with this is like if your LUT is, for example, if a LUT of a camera is very contrasty because you want something very cold and cool and a bit like bleach bypass,
sure,
the LUT is great. But then you get on your actor, you're like, I don't know, a black skin and it's too dark, or the black suit is too dark, and because your LUT is too crunch. And then me, so I work on a CDL all the time. So sure, every shot I do, every day, every shot, I put the two cameras or one camera, and as the operator is rehearsing and I light, I got my live grade, and I rebalance the gammas. So every dailies are balanced, and I can also change the color scheme, see, more cyan, more this. So I don't do extreme color correction, but I do control all of it. So the dailies are very equal and good, and to my taste. So bottom line, yes, the editor gets the dailies that I did the way I want. If I have somebody doing dailies at night, they're going to follow my CDL. They're going to just fix it. Fix the black a little bit, make it better, or change a few days that were difficult. But at the end, the editing is done and it has at least a basic color correction. Then it goes to final post. I'm always asking to the final post to start from my CDL. Why? Because I want my palette to be there. And second of all, very importantly, is because I want to spend the time properly in final color correction. Now we can go in secondary, meaning all the reds of the show, you wanted them to be burnt orange. Now you tweak and you change them. Me, I don't do that on set. Now the black level, let's get them, let's diffuse the black a bit because it's too hard. Let's see, there's many layers you can do, but I try this usually in a few scenes. So it's, you have to light, you have to create your lighting, and that's the key, the most important thing.
Well, I think that's a really great place for us to leave it. Pierre, where can people find you if you do any social media? Do you do an Instagram or anything? Do you have, you want to shout out your Instagram handle so people can follow you there?
Sure. I'm trying to keep up with Instagram, but I'm not so bad, but I'm trying to. So my Instagram is PierreGill_DP. And let me check. Yeah, Pierre Gill, PierreGill_DP. And I got a few posts. It's nice. But yeah, I would love people to follow, and I can share more. And I'll have to share anyway. I'll have to share my knowledge and everything. I swear, I did mini masterclass and I love it.
We're also going to put a link to your Instagram in our show notes over at Cam Noir. Pierre, thank you so much for being on the show. It was a real delight to chat with you.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Thanks so much. It's really nice to talk about all this. The good souvenirs from my shoot of Dune Prophecy. Thank you very much.
All right, so that was Pierre Gill. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Pierre. Congratulations on Dune. Holy crap. Awesome stuff.
And now, Short Ends.
It is our time for our famed patent-pending segment called Short Ends. What's stuck in your craw this week?
So I came across this show. I'm way, way late to the game, and some of you listeners might already know this show. But for me, it was like a complete fresh discovery. I think I've been watching it on Amazon Prime. It's a show, it's a TV series that came out in 2016 called Swedish Dicks. And it's about like two Swedish private detectives in Los Angeles as they're solving kind of like really wacky crimes. And it stars Peter, I think I'm pronouncing his last name hopefully correctly, Peter Stormare.
And I believe it's Stormare.
Stormare, okay. And Johan Glans, and they're both very talented Swedish actors. And the thing that kind of blew my mind is when all of a sudden, out of the blue, Keanu Reeves starts showing up in the show as well. And I was like, whoa.
Always a good sign.
Always a good sign. I love Keanu Reeves, but I also love the two main guys. And it's just like this oddball. It's almost like something like if you can kind of imagine, it's got a little bit like some aspects of like, you know, like Airplane or Naked Gun. But it's also a little bit more realistic in its depiction of, you know, Los Angeles and the mysteries that these guys are trying to solve, but it's also kind of incredibly silly. It's just kind of like a bizarre show that I never heard of. I talk to people, I'm like, hey, have you guys ever heard of Swedish Dicks? And people are like, no, I never heard of that show. And I'm like, this is one of the greatest TV shows that I've seen in a while. I'm like literally cracking up laughing as I'm watching these two guys just kind of go on this like really bizarre.
Where is it streaming again?
It's streaming on Amazon Prime. I believe it might also be on Tubi as well.
Oh, nice.
And I don't know. I would highly recommend it because it's probably something that, you know, just like I missed it the first time around. I think probably a lot of people didn't pop up on their radar, but it's just so much fun. It's rare for me to like kind of watch a show that I'm just literally like cracking up laughing as I'm watching it. And this is one of them. And I think like they had two seasons, I believe. It's long been off the air. I mean, it's almost a decade old. But
wow,
I'm like, you know, this is a cool show. I highly recommend people check it out.
How crappy is it that 2016 is almost a decade ago? Oh my god!
Don't get me started.
I keep saying yada yada yada. We're all dead of old age. It reminds me of a story. I was talking to a friend of mine who's Swedish. His name is Yoni. And I asked him about the Muppet Show in Sweden. I said, did you have it? He said, yeah. I'm like, what did they call the Swedish chef?
Just call him like, chef.
Well, what he said, and I'll never forget, he said, oh, they said he was Norwegian. We all know they're a bunch of assholes.
I think that's great. That's so awesome.
In telling the story, I'm going to create some international tension between Sweden and Norway.
Of course. I think they obviously have issues. So, Ben, why don't you tell me what your one cool thing is?
I actually invited you to come see it with me, and you didn't go because your Regal Pass, you took a month off. It's the new movie Companion, directed by Drew Hancock and shot by a DP named Eli Bourne. And it is it's a horror movie, sort of horror sci-fi. It stars Sophie Thatcher and Jack Quaid. Sophie Thatcher, who I have to admit, every time I see her, I'm like, God damn, who is she? She's brilliant. And I've seen her in three things now: Yellow Jackets, Heretic, and this. And each time, I wouldn't have thought it was the same person. She's a freaking chameleon, and she is the lead in this, and she is wonderful, wonderful. Eli Bourne shot it, a DP named Eli Bourne, and the only other credit of his that I was very familiar with was the remake of Hellraiser, I guess the reboot of Hellraiser that came out few years ago.
That was great.
He's got some other stuff. This movie is don't see any trailers if you're going to go see it. The trailer gives away way too much. It's got some great twists. And I don't think I had even seen a trailer. I had heard that it was twisty and I'm like, okay, I'll just skip all the trailers. And I went and saw it. Really good, sort of confined space. Like it doesn't take place over, you know, the entire continental United States. It's basically mostly on a sprawling estate near the woods. Mm-hmm. Does some really inspired and unsuspectable things. And I've mentioned Eli Bourne twice now. I think his cinematography is amazing. I look forward to seeing what he does in the future. And it's weird because like this movie, as I was reading about it, like in the trades, they were saying, you know, it had underperformed at the box office. Supposedly it was a $10 million movie, which we're seeing more movies in that range. You know, The Brutalist was, you know, which is nominated for a bunch of Oscars and was shot in freaking VistaVision, was like a $10 million movie. We're seeing, you know, Long Legs supposedly was a $10 million movie. So we're seeing more movies kind of in that range, getting a theatrical, getting a nice wide theatrical. And it made between domestic and international, it made $15 million last weekend. So it's like, even if you double the budget for P&A, it's still probably going to be in profit. Then they're going to pay something for streaming. Like, I feel like it's, you know, is it a giant runaway hit? I hope so, but you know, it didn't seem to make as much of a splash going up against the also awesome Dog Man, which since I have a 6-year-old son, I had to go see, but Dog Man's awesome. But I definitely was a worthwhile film. I recommend it to anyone who is a fan of horror, thrillers, or sci-fi. That's as spoilery as I will get about it, because it's kind of all three.
Well, I definitely want to check it out. And sorry I missed it.
So that about wraps it up for us. Kaze, where can people find you online if they want to, you know, hire you to make a movie or color grade something or do a score or do visual effects?
Oh boy, like it's all those things and more. I mean, they can find me at musicbykaze.com. That's my main music website. I have a directing website called moviesbykaze.com. Mm. And if they're on Instagram, they can find me at Kaze, K-A-Y-S, filmmaker, Kaze filmmaker. And come and find me. And I'm always like kind of, it's always fun to hear from people that listen, you know, that are a fan of the podcast. So
do you get a lot of, because I'm always telling people to bug you. Does anyone ever reach out?
I do get emails from people, and it's really pleasant because, sometimes it catches me by surprise. Somebody's like, hey, I'm just saying hello. And I'm like, that's awesome. So thank you guys to all of you that have emailed. It's always pleasant to receive those.
Cool. Well, you can find me at benrock.com or Neptune Salad at Blue Sky. I'm still kind of on Twitter, but I don't really check it very much. But LinkedIn, all that good stuff. So, Kaze, I'm not going to make you thank yourself. So, so now is when we acknowledge everyone who makes this show possible. Of course, our number one person is Alana Cody, our producer, who sets up all these incredible interviews, who handles all the schedules and spreadsheets. You know, like nothing is successfully done in this world without somebody managing, scheduling, and spreadsheeting stuff. And sometimes that's me. And when it's not me, I send all the appreciation to the person who does that. Like the logistics of this maybe don't sound that complicated, but it's a lot. And Alana kicks all the ass at it. We got to thank Michael. Do you remember his nickname I've given him?
What is the nickname?
Indispensable Dispenza.
I see. That's such a dad thing to say.
Oh yeah, no, I've learned a lot about dad jokes being a dad, and I'll tell you, it's all about revenge. So Michael Dispenza, who's editing this, and hopefully won't get you and me canceled for having a conversation about Emilia Perez. And last but never least, I got to thank you. You're right here. Thank you for creating all the music that you created, Lo, these 11 years ago that we use for the show. And Ilya and I keep repeatedly saying we have to go over the new tracks you sent us, and then we never do because we're both busy and he's in Portland and I'm in Los Angeles.
So. Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on the show, and thank you for having my music on it.
Awesome. Would you like to take us out?
I would say sure, and I'll go with that's a wrap.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.